This is a special report from NPR News on food insecurity in the United States. I'm Michelle Martin. It's one of the most urgent yet sometimes hidden crises this country is facing. We're talking about not having enough food or not having enough good, nutritious food when you need it. Now, poverty and food insecurity have always existed here in the U.S., but the pandemic, as it has with almost everything, has made the problem worse for many across the country. A poll of households in the four largest U.S. cities by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health found that in Houston, for example, one in three households have had serious problems affording food since the coronavirus outbreak began, and about one in five don't get enough food to eat every day. We're going to hear about the personal toll of hunger, the systems that are meant to provide assistance and where they fall short, and the people working on finding solutions. To begin, we wanted to understand the scale of the crisis, so we've called on Reverend Eugene Cho. He is the president and CEO of Bread for the World. That's a faith-based nonprofit working to enact policies addressing hunger globally. Reverend Cho, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Reverend Cho, let me start by saying that we know this is a global problem, and we're going to talk about these global issues. But for now, we want to focus on the U.S. Do we have any way of quantifying how much worse the crisis has gotten since the pandemic began?
Well, first of all, I'm so glad that you're covering this topic. The numbers are staggering, and I think this is the reason why it's hard for us to quantify. We're talking 54 million people in our backyards, in our cities, in our nation, right now. That's about one in six Americans. And certainly is impacting children particularly very heavy.
And talk a little bit more about that. I was going to ask you about that. Are there specific groups of people that are especially vulnerable?
Well, we've heard it said now that the pandemic, as well as its secondary consequences, it's impacting children, especially Black and brown families, African-American, Latino families. In fact, the recent Census Bureau data indicates that nearly 40% of Black and Latino families with children are struggling to put food on the table.
So what are some of the main drivers of food insecurity in the United States? And is it different from what's driving food insecurity elsewhere in the world? I just want to mention here that according to the United Nations World Food Program, about 265 million people are facing life-threatening levels of food insecurity globally. So what are the drivers around the world? Is it the same or different in the United States?
It's a little different. A few years ago, what led to some of the hunger crisis around the world was conflict, climate change, and then when you place on top of those things the reality of the global COVID-19 pandemic, there's been an extreme lockdown globally. I think there are some nations that have seen countries like the United States, Brazil, India have these tremendous high infection rates, and so their government have gone into these extreme lockdowns. So some people might see these statistics of infections globally, and they might be surprised that the infection rate isn't as high at the same rate as the United States. So less people are dying because of COVID, but what they are being dramatically impacted by is the food systems. People just aren't able to access the food.
I think a lot of people are surprised that there is a food insecurity problem in the United States. Because I think people will say, well, gee, you know, what about these programs that I hear so much about? What about these programs that I'm paying my taxes for?
Well, I think it's a fair question. So just to maybe take us back about a year, the census reported that in 2019 in the United States, we had the lowest poverty rate since the government started tracking it. So that's really tremendous progress. The safety net programs that you mentioned, things like the SNAP program, the WIC program, those were working and those were taking people away from the safety net programs to be able to, again, assume life on their own. But I think what this pandemic has caused is exploited some of the fragility of our lives, of our society, and of our safety net as well. And so as a result, organizations like Bread for the World, we're calling upon our lawmakers, upon Congress, upon the White House to amplify, we need to strengthen these safety net programs during this time, because it makes sense. This is a unprecedented epidemic that we're facing. So the nation and our lawmakers, we need to act in a tremendously unprecedented, compassionate, empathetic way to help those who are suffering from the hunger crisis right now.
Do you mind if I ask if you have any personal experience with this yourself? I mean, apart from the, you are obviously clergy and you work in this space, but I just, do you mind if I ask, have you ever been hungry?
You know, it's an interesting question. And one of the reasons why I joined Bread for the World was because of my parents' story. Both my parents were born in what is now called North Korea. My father is 85 years old, and he still shares these really incredulous stories of having to pull out grass from the ground to consume it to satisfy his hunger pangs. And it's nothing recent, but about 21, 22 years ago, my wife and I, we had ventured off to start our own church, and things didn't quite turn out as we had envisioned. And so I experienced unemployment for the first time in my adult life, and it was a very challenging time. And I can tell you right now, had it not been for the safety net program of a program called the WIC program, Women, Infant, and Children, had it not been for that program, for my wife and I, then our two kids, we would have been in tremendous trouble. It's 21, 22 years ago, but I still hold that story very dear. This is the reality for one out of six neighbors. And I want to just make it that much more personal. It's not just people over there. It's not just Americans in some faraway state. It's far away from us. It's our neighbors, one out of every six.
That is the Reverend Eugene Cho. He is president and CEO of Bread for the World. That's a faith-based nonprofit working to enact policies addressing hunger in the United States and around the world. Reverend Cho, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
So what does food insecurity look like and feel like for the 1 in 6 people who are projected to experience it this year? We went to find out.
I need one more volunteer to load cars.
On a Friday earlier this month, we visited a food distribution site in Bethesda, Maryland. It's in Montgomery County, which is one of the wealthiest counties in the country. But as in many places, the need for food has grown since the beginning of the pandemic.
People will line up and come right around here. You'll see they've already started lining up.
Before the distribution is set to begin, volunteers like John Ross are unloading some of the more than 200 boxes of food to be handed out. Stacks of bread are piled high on one table, prepared meals and bags of coffee on the other.
It's been shocking to, I think, all of us to see this on the ground right here, right now. So we're doing the best we can.
An hour before the event is scheduled to begin, a long line of cars is already winding through the parking lot at the Bethesda Chevy Chase Rescue Squad, a volunteer firefighting group that loaned out their space. We met Peter Warner while he was waiting in his car.
Last week, I arrived here at 20 minutes after 1. There were a quarter mile worth of cars in line. I was fortunate to get a spot, and they had almost run out of food 20 minutes after the starting bell. Anyone who got here after 1:30 p.m. was totally out of luck.
Warner arrived early this time. He works part-time at Safeway and receives a monthly disability check of $1,000. That has to cover all of his basics: rent, medicine, keeping his car running, and of course, food.
I also am now getting $194 a month in SNAP food stamps, which is invaluable, but today is the 18th. My food stamp award comes in on the 22nd. I have to eat for the next 4 days.
As we spoke to people, the line of cars kept growing, eventually snaking down the busy street outside the parking lot.
How many families?
Two.
Okay, two.
Many of the people we talked with in line didn't want to say much about their situation. It seemed like a source of shame and pain. One or two said that falling short on food even for a couple of days a month was a chronic problem in an area where the cost of living is high. But most of the people we spoke with said the coronavirus pandemic or the steps taken to contain it was the main reason they needed help with food right now. Linda is one of them. She was picking up food for her daughter and five grandchildren. Before the pandemic, she worked as a housekeeper.
I laid off since May. I'm trying to apply for unemployment if I can.
That unemployment application has yet to be approved, and 5 months without work or any financial aid is taking its toll.
It's too difficult, really. I'm struggling. I hope the pandemic, it's finished soon. You know, it's so difficult, but we are still blessed to have somebody to provide some food for us. So we will still thanks to God.
We also met Adam. He's a father of two. He and his wife are both collecting unemployment and seeking food assistance for the first time in their lives.
Both me and my wife are on furlough since March. And now just with the extended benefits down, the money's it's a lot lower now. So it helps. You know, any little bit helps now because you never know what's going to happen tomorrow or the next day. So it's good just to be prepared because you never know how long this is going to last.
There hadn't been any food distribution in the Bethesda Chevy Chase area until August. That's when Andrew Friedson, the Montgomery County Council member for the area, brought together a coalition of nonprofit, commercial, and faith-based groups to distribute food. You can hear that we're both talking through our masks.
This is an affluent area. Montgomery County is affluent in Maryland, and which means it's one of the most affluent areas in the country. So when did you realize that you really did need something like this?
Well, it has always been needed. I think there's more poverty in Montgomery County and even in places like Bethesda than people realize in normal times. And during COVID, it has just gone through the roof, the challenges that we face.
But Friedson says since the start of the pandemic, the need for help with food and rent are the two biggest issues his office is hearing about from constituents.
We desperately need federal government support. The CARES Act was great. That's largely what is funding the public efforts on these, the CARES Act funding, the $183 million that the county has received, but it's nowhere near enough.
And while feeding those in need is the goal of this distribution event, volunteer John Ross says it's about more than just the food.
What we want to do out here, too, is show people that people care. It's not just the calories, but it's the care that comes along with this, too, that we're all together in this, and we all need to be part of that.
We're going to focus now on the programs that are meant to address people's needs. What does the government provide and where has it fallen short? To answer that, NPR's food and agriculture correspondent, Dan Charles, is here. Dan, welcome.
Good to be here.
So first of all, would you just tell us about the systems that are currently in place to help people get access to the food they need, especially now in the middle of this pandemic?
The backbone of that system is called SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. This program has its limits, which I'll get to, but it is really important and probably does not get enough credit.
And that's what used to be called food stamps?
That's right. There are a couple of things about SNAP that just make it great. First of all, it's really quick in responding to a crisis like this. You sign up, benefits get loaded electronically on a card. Instantly, you can go to a grocery store and buy food. I find that kind of amazing. The other thing is it is really efficient. It takes advantage of the normal commercial supply chain for food. You know, like grocery stores, they're already there. The government doesn't have to come up with a new way of delivering food. And it can handle huge numbers of people. More than 1 out of 8 Americans is in this program right now.
What about the paperwork involved, though? You have to prove you qualify. Is that a barrier to participation?
Well, it is a barrier. I mean, you have to provide documentation of income, residency, and you can imagine, I mean, that can be a problem. If, let's say, you've just been evicted, you've lost your address, that can make things really hard. Or also, part of the rules of the program are, if you're an undocumented immigrant, you do not qualify. Your American-born children who are citizens, they do qualify, but there's evidence that a lot of families who are in that situation don't even try to get into the program.
I can imagine there's a lot of sort of philosophical and political opinion behind that qualification or that standard. But what about the benefit level? I mean, is it enough to meet the need? If you lost your job and you're trying to provide healthy food to your children, sufficient healthy food to your children, can you do it with SNAP?
It is hard. The benefit level was set up to meet some minimum requirement, and according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, is sufficient. But we're talking just a few dollars a day per person, right? $150 to $200 a month. That's the maximum SNAP benefit. That would be really hard.
Could the government increase those benefits?
Yes, it could. And there is a big political fight going on right now about that. Now, I should say the Trump administration did bump everybody in the program up to that maximum level. But the Democrats want to go further and increase the maximum level by 15%. That's what the Obama administration did during the Great Recession 10 years ago. The Democrats passed a provision like that in the House, but the Senate has not gone along.
I think also when people think about getting food to people who need it, they think about food banks and food pantries, where places where people can show up and get food for free. Are they playing a role right now? And how big of a role are they playing?
Well, they certainly do help, especially for people who fall through the cracks. Maybe people didn't get their SNAP paperwork done for whatever reason. But they are not a great way to meet the scale of the problem that we're looking at right now. Physically getting food to all those distribution points is really time-consuming, very labor-intensive. I mean, one of the big reasons food banks were established was to do something different, really. It was to reduce food waste, to find a better outlet for food that grocery stores were going to throw away, or for food that the government had already purchased from farmers to help the farmers out. To massively get food to people like SNAP does? Not really. I mean, compared to SNAP, food banks distribute something like 10, 12% as much food.
Dan, I think a lot of people might remember pictures and stories that we heard from earlier in this year, and especially in the growing season, when we saw pictures of like milk being poured down the drain or vegetables and fruits being left to rot in the fields because farmers couldn't get those items to their customers because everything was shut down. Why did that happen? Like, why couldn't these farmers get these products to the people who needed food?
Food supply chains are amazing and they're really efficient, but they're sometimes inflexible. For instance, a vast majority of the tomatoes in Florida are grown for what they call food service. You know, that's cruise ships and restaurants and stores. That's how they package the tomatoes. That's the kind of tomatoes they grow. And suddenly, with the lockdown, those places went out of business. They couldn't just like send them to the grocery store. They didn't have that relationship, and they weren't growing the type of product that was easy to send to a grocery store. It was like a total collapse of the system, but it was pretty brief. And you're not seeing, basically, farmers are not destroying crops and dairy farmers are not dumping milk anymore. People have adjusted.
I was going to ask you about that. There was this Farmers to Families program. The point was to buy food that farmers were having trouble selling and distribute it through food banks. Is this up and running? Is this up and running, and has this been effective?
It is up and running. They funded it with $4 billion. They've delivered tens of millions of these food boxes to food banks for distribution. But the program has had a lot of problems, to be honest. Contractors were supposed to deliver food, these boxes, all the way to, you know, the trunks of cars. Many of them didn't do it, so food banks had to spend a lot of money taking over that job. Food didn't necessarily go to the places where it was most needed. And honestly, it was just not very efficient. You know, moving all that, setting up a new supply chain was really expensive and takes a lot of work. And, you know, compared to the amount of money they spent on that program, the same amount of money distributed through SNAP would have delivered a lot more food.
So I see your point, Dan, about sort of the efficiencies here. But is money for SNAP, more money for SNAP, all that's needed? I mean, from what we're hearing, there are all kinds of, you know, distribution glitches here, all kinds of kind of mismatches between the need, where the food's being produced, how the food gets to the people who need it. And it just seems like there are a lot of food and nutrition problems that this one program isn't solving. Is that right?
I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, when you step back and think about it, let's take the example of SNAP. You got your SNAP benefits card, you got your benefits, you go try to find food at the grocery store. There are a lot of places in the country where, for reasons of poverty and all kinds of reasons, it is pretty hard to find stores that are selling a lot of good fresh produce. There are neighborhoods where the corner stores are not great. There are rural areas and small towns where all you have is something like a Dollar General. And so that's the food environment, and that's a much bigger problem. That was the situation before the pandemic, and I'm afraid it's still going to be the case when the pandemic passes.
That is Dan Charles, NPR's food and agriculture correspondent. Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That challenging food environment we just heard about is exactly what one family near Champaign, Illinois, has been coping with since the start of the pandemic. Harvest Public Media's Dana Cronin has their story.
Everything the Pleasure family cooks and eats revolves around their garden.
We have gotten a lot of tomatoes from this one.
10-year-old Joshua has been gardening since he was little. Right now, the family's community garden plot is planted with fall squash.
Oh, I'm cooking literally every day with something that I've grown. Every day, which I absolutely love because it saves trips to the grocery store.
Joshua's mom, Janelle Pleasure, says food has always been central to her family. One of their favorite activities is to spin a globe, put a finger down, and cook a dish from that country. But they haven't done that since the start of the pandemic, when Pleasure says things got hard.
There's not a belt to tighten. There's no wiggle room here. I'm unemployed, and there are limited things that I can do.
She became a single mom of three kids when her husband left 2 years ago. Without his stream of income, it became difficult to afford the basics, including food. Then came the pandemic. She lost her job almost immediately, and when her kids' schools shut down, it meant no more school meals. She is, however, receiving $125 per month through an expanded food stamps program.
Literally, the $125 I can spend in like a week because my kids eat like grown men, like a football team. I don't know where they put it.
Pleasure doesn't waste anything. Her kitchen counter is lined with jars of pickled vegetables from the garden, and her freezer is stacked with leftovers. A self-described coupon queen, she shows off her pantry, where she stockpiles food she finds on sale.
They're organic, made with fruit juice, and they're like fruit pops, but these are normally, what did she say, $6.59, and I got them for a dollar. I was like, I'm going to take 40 of those. Thank you.
And yet, sometimes it's not enough. That's when she pays a visit to the local food pantry where her kids used to volunteer.
When we actually had to be participants in it, I think maybe there was a little bit of confusion for them. Like, I don't want to put words in their mouths, but it maybe was a little shameful. Like, why are we here? Why do we have to do this? So I stopped bringing them because looking at that and looking at them, it made me feel like less of a parent.
Pleasure is far from alone in the struggle to afford food. In fact, food insecurity rates for families with children have tripled during the pandemic. And families of color are even worse off. Black families like the Pleasures report rates of food insecurity twice that of white families. Experts say the easiest way for the government to help would be to increase food stamp benefits. Janelle Pleasure says she's grateful for the help she has received.
That took like a huge weight off my shoulders because now I just have to worry about, will the power be on, you know, as opposed to power or food. I'd rather my kids eat than have lights. Like, you know, we can get candles. Not a big deal.
Even if it was in the dark, she says she's always been able to put some kind of food on the table. For NPR News, I'm Dana Cronin in Champaign, Illinois.
As we just heard, schools are a lifeline for many parents struggling to feed their families. Free and reduced lunch programs aim to help students get access to nutritious meals. But when most of the nation's K-12 schools shut down in the spring, these programs transformed almost overnight. With cafeterias closed, schools began handing out bagged meals in their parking lots. In the early days of the pandemic, this seemed to work pretty well. But NPR's Corey Turner reports too many kids are now missing out on the meals they need.
Before COVID-19, Arizona's Tucson Unified School District dished out a lot of meals.
A normal school day, we serve 35,000 total meals a day. That's breakfast, lunch, and supper.
Lindsay Aguilar is the district's food services director. When I spoke with her earlier this month, she said the number of meals served so far this year had plummeted by nearly 90%. That's because lots of parents and caregivers are back at work and can't get to the meal pickup sites each day.
it's disheartening because I know those kids, you know, they still are in need of the food and families are struggling even more now than ever.
Aguilar says she feels a huge responsibility to do more to reach those kids who need those 35,000 meals a day.
Realistically, I know I'm not going to get 35,000, but can I get 10? Can I get 12? Like, you know, how can I get these families to come or how can I get to them? I joke all the time, but I'm like, we need Amazon Prime out of our warehouse.
We come up with ways every week to find a new way to get meals to our kids.
Alicia Wright heads the nutrition program for schools in Fulton County, Georgia. And she, like nutrition directors all over the country, says she's losing sleep thinking about how to reach the children who can't reach them.
Every day. I worry about them every day. I think about it every night.
Wright and her team are freezing hamburgers and lasagna rolls so they can pack a whole week's worth of meals into just one pickup.
My best day was last week.
That's because Wright and her team were testing a new plan to pack all that food onto a school bus to get closer to the kids who need it. Parents and caregivers were thrilled, Wright says, telling her,
"This is so great because we could not get to the food stop. We didn't have transportation."
In Tucson, Aguilar and her team are also packing meals onto buses and delivering them at more than 60 stops. And it all matters, says researcher Lauren Bauer at the Brookings Institution, because one in five families say their kids aren't getting enough food and they don't have enough resources to buy more.
That means that children are going hungry.
And Bauer says the vast majority of kids who could be getting school meals aren't. While schools are doing everything they can to change that, Congress is also trying to help. In the spring, lawmakers created a program called Pandemic EBT. It basically took the value of those school meals that kids weren't getting and put it, usually a few hundred dollars, onto a debit card that families could then use at the grocery store. Lauren Bauer says Pandemic EBT reached a lot of families.
And it kept between 2.5 and 3.5 million children out of hunger this summer.
The program was set to expire by the end of September, but in a rare show of bipartisanship, the House recently voted overwhelmingly in support of an extension through fiscal year 2021. The Senate is expected to do the same. Corey Turner, NPR News.
Now to Oakland, California, to meet Juan Vaca. He is the principal at Global Family Elementary School, where all of the 453 students receive free or reduced lunch.
We have like 98% Latino, Latinx, and we have students that are newcomers, or English language learners, or newcomers coming from other countries with very minimal language and very minimal educational experience, no schooling. So we try to find ways to actually make sure that we're also holding them in a way that they actually have the support that they need to be able to be successful.
His school has always had students who needed help getting food or enough food, but things got worse when the pandemic hit.
Families had to figure out, how are we going to supplement this food that we used to get at the school? It's difficult to actually fathom, to think that we take some simple things like lunch and meals and breakfast for granted, right? Because it's expected and it's there. And once it's removed and you're given something else, a different avenue to actually obtain all those things, it's difficult. It's hard. And it's our job, I think, to find ways to mend that and connect families to these services.
This summer, Vaca worked at a food distribution center at another school in the area. But families from his school couldn't make it, usually because they lacked transportation or were quarantined. So he got creative.
And what I would do is I would go check in the morning at that school and make sure that everything was going well. And what I would do is I would bring food back because I knew that their families would be needing this food. And I would house it at my site. And parents know that they could come and pick it up. Or I would drop off on my way back to my school.
Still, that wasn't enough. So Vaca and the staff at Global Family got even more hands-on. Teachers would buy groceries for struggling families and do wellness checks. Eventually, Vaca arranged a food drive at his school twice a month. He says more than 100 families show up each time.
They're very thankful. They always thank us, and they always want to know when's the next one. And because families leave with a lot of bags. Like, it's not just, here's two apples, here's two. No, it's... there's a lot of food, and I think they're very grateful. I think it's sometimes words don't express what they're feeling. I just, the smiles on their face, their thank yous, says a million words. And I just feel like it speaks volumes, right?
Vaca says the drives are a chance to check in with students and their families. That's where he learns how they're adapting to distance learning amid the pandemic.
It's tough because you have these students who are having to take these roles, right? These roles of making sure that they can't, you know, mom and dad have to be quarantined. And now you have to kind of fend for yourself. So it's one of those situations where they're very grateful. They're very grateful for what we provide them. But it's not consistent, right? We're not there every single day. We're not there with them 24 hours a day. And we can provide one need, or we can try to help them overcome one obstacle, but there's still so many more.
Despite the challenges, Vaca remains optimistic. The food drives continue, as do the check-ins. He says he learned a lot in the early days of the pandemic and has adapted to this new normal.
We need to just continue working at making the drive, striving to do what we're doing in regards to closing this food insecurity gap and making sure that at least some of their basic needs are met to the capacity that we can provide, so that it's one less thing they have to worry about.
That's Juan Vaca, principal at Global Family Elementary School in Oakland, California. Now, it seems fairly obvious that one of the root causes of food insecurity is poverty. If you don't have enough money, then it stands to reason that it's likely to be hard to get enough food, or at least enough good, nutritious food on a regular basis. But what might not be so obvious is why so many people in the United States are still in poverty. According to recent data from the U.S. Census Bureau, the number one factor driving Americans into poverty is medical expenses. That's right, medical expenses. In 2019 alone, nearly 8 million Americans fell below the poverty line because of medical bills. Anti-poverty advocates say one solution to that problem is to expand Medicaid across the country. Jim Carnes is one of those people. He is the policy director of Alabama Arise. That's a nonprofit that is advocating for policies to end poverty in Alabama, including by expanding Medicaid. And he is with us now from Montgomery. Jim Carnes, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
So walk me through this. I mean, how do medical expenses end up forcing Americans into poverty? And I ask because I think a lot of people would assume that Medicaid, which is a program to provide medical care to people of low income, would keep that from happening. So how does this work?
Well, the Census Bureau measures poverty in two different ways. The older way that we've been doing for 50 plus years is strictly cash income based. And it looks at how many households have cash income less than three times the cost of what the Health and Human Services Department calls a minimum food diet for their family size? So the second way is called the supplemental poverty measure, and it takes into account things beyond just cash income. It takes into account additional resources in a family, such as public benefits that are designed to help lift people out of poverty, things like food stamps and rental assistance and things like that. It also takes into account expenses that are not a part of their traditional basic expense spectrum, like rent and transportation and food and clothing and that sort of thing. So it takes into account things that reduce the available resources in a family. And the factor that reduces household income or spending money, you might say, the most is medical debt.
Break it down for me. Like, how does that work? What tends to be the case? Is it people with chronic health conditions and the cost of treating those conditions is high, or is it a catastrophic incident? Or why is it that medical expenses force people, that many people, into poverty every year?
Yeah, there are a number of factors moving at the same time. A huge one is the number of people without health insurance. But particularly in states like Alabama, which is one of 12 states that have not accepted Medicaid expansion, we have hundreds of thousands of people who don't have that safety net. So number one, they don't have somebody helping them pay their medical bills. When that's the case, a number of other factors kick into play. So you have people who are delaying getting medical care because they don't have a way to pay for it. And when their problem gets unavoidable and they do have to seek care, that care is more expensive because it's late and their condition is worse. So the bills are higher.
Is the connection between healthcare costs, poverty, and food insecurity one that is starting to make sense to people? Are people starting to connect the dots? Because it's not, I mean, if you've lived it, you can see why people would understand it. But if they've never lived through it, then maybe it's not as real. And I just wondered if people are seeing that connection at all.
I think they are. And I'll give you two ways in which I think they're starting to see it. The first one has to do with a major Medicaid reform that Alabama has undertaken. And one component of that reform is the targeting of three of our really bad health measures here in the state. And those are obesity, infant mortality and birth outcomes, and substance use disorders. So there's a real connection there. There's an explicit connection with nutrition, particularly on the obesity and infant mortality side. So while we have a limited Medicaid program that serves mainly children and people with disabilities, the fact that the state and our state leaders are recognizing that we really have to do something about these terrible health outcomes that are related to nutrition tells me that they are opening up to solutions that they may not have considered before. The second thing, and this is more to our current context, I believe that COVID and the impact of COVID that has just taken everybody by surprise in terms of the health disparities, the racial and ethnic disparities in COVID's mortality, are really changing the conversation about unaddressed health problems. We know from all the research now that COVID is most vicious toward people who have underlying unaddressed healthcare problems. And here in Alabama, you can draw a direct line to our high rates of uninsured folks to health problems that go unaddressed.
Before we let you go, as you surely know, Supreme Court Justice, Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died recently. There is now a vacancy on the High Court, and we know that the Supreme Court is scheduled to hear a case that could possibly overturn the Affordable Care Act this fall, which could greatly affect Medicaid expansion. If that happens, I mean, I recognize that's a hypothetical. Where do you go from there?
Rest assured that the advocates around the country are going to be staying in the fight to continue to address the gaping holes in our healthcare system. And there are other ways to go about that work. So we'll just pick up. I'm hoping and praying that it doesn't come to that, that the path forward will be moving up the same path we've had and reaching the goal. But if we don't, and if we get thrown off that path, we'll make another one.
That's Jim Carnes, Policy Director at Alabama Arise. Jim Carnes, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Michelle. I enjoyed it.
As we heard earlier this hour, the coronavirus pandemic has complicated efforts to get food to those who need it in communities all across the country. And that's especially true in the more rural parts of the country. Harvest Public Media's Christina Stella reports on how people in one small town in rural Nebraska have found new ways to feed hungry people.
Lexington, Nebraska, population 11,000, isn't exactly used to traffic. But over the past few months, a line of cars has been forming at the edge of town like clockwork, every Thursday morning since June. They're headed toward a white tent outside St. Anne's Parish in the hopes of picking up a USDA Farmers to Families food box.
Sometimes it's lined up all the way to Highway 30. So there is definitely a need, and it has increased since COVID, for sure.
That's Michaela Kopp of the Lexington Community Foundation. She stands in the heat, directing cars to the tent. Most weeks, 700 boxes of food are gone in an hour. Like many rural areas, food insecurity is a chronic problem in Lexington, where 16% of residents live below the poverty line.
Martha Draskovic, who's managed the town's food pantry for 10 years, says it didn't take long for COVID-19 to give her a surge in demand.
It became clear when my shelves started going empty. So we kind of had to do a new game plan.
Many families rely on their kids getting two meals a day at school. Losing that, coupled with a sudden increase in unemployment, was the perfect storm. People who didn't typically use the pantry or qualify for programs like SNAP were suddenly in need.
But once they were home for 2 to 3 weeks, I mean, they were still out of income, but yet no food.
Empty shelves weren't her only hurdle. Supply chains nationwide were faltering. Tammy Jeffs at the Community Action Partnership of Mid-Nebraska says it was hard to stay afloat without hurting the rest of the town. Jeffs and Draskovic found themselves driving across central Nebraska in search of pantry staples like peanut butter and pasta.
If we go in and buy 40 packs of something and all the grocery store is getting is 50 packs, you've now just sent everybody to your pantry because you bought everything. So,
plus, once they found the food, they had to figure out how to get it to people who couldn't come to the pantry. Some were seniors. Others were workers at the local Tyson meatpacking plant, where hundreds of employees had been quarantined without a way to get food. So Draskovic started delivering.
At first, it was just myself. We were just doing that, and then I kind of, you know, recruited other people to start coming in and just helping.
When it got around town that the pantry was struggling, residents made sure it was stocked.
We started getting different, you know, financial donations, items. Businesses started reaching out, and, you know, now we kind of have a backstock, so we're kind of prepared to see if we get that second roundabout.
Orthman Manufacturing, an agricultural equipment company, is one of the local businesses that's helped distribute food. Plant manager Scott McKelvey says close-knit community ties have made all the difference. He called a friend at the local Rotary Club to bring Hot Meals USA to town, serving 18,000 meals since April.
It doesn't matter if somebody drives up in a 2017 Cadillac decked out to the nines. Nobody cares because you don't know what's going on with that family.
These kinds of mutual aid networks give him hope. Lately, he says, he's needed it.
With everything else that's going on in the United States right now, this is a feel-good moment. And it's not just in the Midwest. There's these moments that are going on all over the country to help feed families in need.
He makes his way back under the tent. Most of the boxes are gone. McKelvey and the other volunteers start loading up their cars and figuring out where to deliver the extra food. It doesn't take them long to make a plan. For NPR News, I'm Christina Stella.
And finally, we're going to focus on solutions to the problem of food insecurity in America. We've spent a lot of time highlighting the problems around how people get food or don't get food and the effect this has on them. But now we want to focus on what better approaches might look like. To help us think this through, we're joined by Earthrin Cousin, who's had a long career thinking about these issues. She previously served as U.S. Ambassador for the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization and executive director of the World Food Program at the United Nations. She's the CEO of Food Systems for the Future, which invests in food and agriculture services to improve nutrition in low-income communities. She's also a visiting scholar at the Center on Food Security and the Environment at Stanford University. Welcome, Ambassador Cousin. Thank you for joining us.
I'm honored by the privilege to spend time with you.
So one of the Sustainable Development Goals adopted at the UN in 2015 is zero hunger, with a target of ending hunger and malnutrition globally by the year 2030. So when people talk about zero hunger, what does that mean?
That means everyone everywhere would have sufficient access to affordable, nutritious food to meet their dietary requirements. And it is possible.
You know, hunger and food insecurity can be, you know, an abstract concept to people when they're not experiencing it. I mean, I think perhaps it's something that people have accepted as normal in some parts of the world. And I just wonder, is there a global sense that this is a problem that can be solved? It's biblical in some ways. I mean, there are passages of scripture many people have read that will sort of suggest that this is an unsolvable problem. You know, the poor shall always be among us, that kind of, you know, idea. Do you think that there is at least the belief globally that we can get to zero hunger, that hunger is a problem that can be solved in the modern world?
There's very much the belief that we can achieve zero hunger. We need to think about what that will require. When we think about hunger, we think about acute disruptions in food systems, war, drought. And so having systems in place that provide access to food for people during acute disruptions in the food system is critical to addressing hunger challenges. But we also have on the other side the challenge of ensuring that we invest in agricultural development for productive, resilient systems that allow people to feed themselves on an ongoing basis.
You've written a lot about the fact that often this issue arises, you know, from conflict, like war. But as we've learned, and as we've been talking about throughout this hour, this is a problem in the United States, too. So what are one or two things that would make our food systems here in the United States more equitable, would bring us closer to ending hunger here?
When we talk about food security, we're also talking about nutrition. And when you have the malnutrition problem in the United States, which is obesity, and the health consequences that occur from that, what we've realized as a result of COVID is that we have our own set of malnutrition and food-related problems in the United States that are directly related to a food system that does not meet the needs of low-income and underserved populations. But we can, even here in the United States, we can do things that will change that paradigm. We focus on the charitable system, and we should have a charitable system that responds to emergencies, that ensures that people have access to food. But we also need to invest in businesses that can provide access to nutritious foods, that people, giving people the ability to purchase the food that they need to meet their requirements and not just stand in line for a box.
Are there things that individuals can do if they don't, you know, own a farm, if they don't, you know, sit on a board of directors? Is there something that people who are listening to our conversation right now could do to help solve this problem?
There are food policy action councils that have sprung up all around the country that your listeners should Google and get involved. There are also new farm-to-consumer systems coming online that will allow for purchase directly from farmers that will make our system more agile by giving people the ability to purchase food that's closer to them. We also have new laws coming on the books that allow for the consumers who are entrepreneurs to begin to develop their own food products and sell them at farmers markets. What we'll find as we move forward is that people getting involved with their food and knowing the system, knowing who their farmer is, where that food is produced, is going to create a different demand for food in our society that will result in ever more nutritious food becoming available.
You know, the complexity of this, of these issues that, as I said, again, the whole question of poverty and hunger, you know, global conflict, et cetera, may make some people feel like hopeless, like nothing will work. Is there anything you can share, like a story, maybe a personal experience, that help you to understand that solutions to this problem are possible?
When I was executive director of the World Food Program, I never took pictures with babies with flies on their eyes and bloated bellies, because we've all gotten far too accustomed to seeing that as the face of poverty and hunger. But what I witnessed were men and women who were working as smallholder farmers, as entrepreneurs, to provide for the food needs of their children, as well as for the markets that they supported that provided them with income. And so what I always did was take pictures with fat, healthy babies to demonstrate to the world what was possible when the investments were made that allowed people to support their own food needs by creating the businesses, creating the agricultural production, supporting the systems that would ensure the availability of affordable, nutritious food. That demonstrated that we could change the outcome for people by helping them change their own lives.
Ambassador Earthwind Cousin is CEO of Food Systems for the Future. She's also a visiting scholar at the Center on Food Security and the Environment at Stanford University. And she previously served as executive director of the UN's World Food Program from 2012 until 2017. Earthwind Cousin, Ambassador Cousin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michelle.
This has been a special report from NPR News on food insecurity in the United States. I'm Michelle Martin. Thank you for listening.